Psalm 29, a psalm of David. Give unto Yahweh, O you mighty ones, give unto Yahweh glory and strength. Give unto Yahweh the glory due to his name. Worship Yahweh in the beauty of holiness. The voice of Yahweh is over the waters. The God of glory thunders. Yahweh is over many waters. The voice of Yahweh is powerful. The voice of Yahweh is full of majesty. The voice of Yahweh breaks the cedars. Yes, Yahweh splinters the cedars of Lebanon. He makes them also skip like a calf. Lebanon and Syrian, like a young wild ox. The voice of Yahweh divides the flames of fire. The voice of Yahweh shakes the wilderness. Yahweh shakes the wilderness of Kadesh. The voice of Yahweh makes the deer give birth and strips the forests bare. And in his temple, everyone says, glory. Yahweh sat enthroned at the flood. Yahweh sits as king forever. Yahweh will give strength to his people. Yahweh will bless his people with peace. So far, the reading of God's inspired and inerrant word. In this psalm, the Lord ties his own glory, his own strength, his own greatness to his strengthening and blessing his people. Notice that the covenant name of God, Yahweh, appears 18 times in this psalm. And so you have three pictures of the glory of Yahweh. One, his glory in glory in heaven, which is in verses 1 and 2. The second, especially in the flood, in verses 3 through 7. The third, in redeeming his people and gathering his people, and the fact that this God, who is powerful over all creation, is the one who gathers his people round himself, near himself, and displays his glory especially to them in a way that isn't displayed anywhere else. And that's in verses 8 and 9. And then in verse 10, he pulls the glory of Yahweh from the first three sections, or four if you separate out verses 5 through 7. We're going to take them together. And then he applies them in verse 11. The Lord has given his people himself to be all that he is for all that we need or could desire him to be. And so we are the people of the glorious God in verses 10 through 11. First then, verses, yes?
Stephanie said that she's not able to do it anymore. I'm sure something happened. We just got part of the infectivity issues.
Okay.
That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, we have bandwidth and the little microphone thingy is moving. I don't know. It could be there's one more step in between at the sermon audio server as well. So, and I suppose a lot of churches are going on a Wednesday night. So in the first section, Yahweh, the glorious God of heaven, the Psalm of David, give unto Yahweh, O you mighty ones. It's literally sons of gods, and it uses a plural of a generic word for God, El, but it's not Elohim, which is the not one Elohim or dual Elohim, but at least three or more Elohim that God uses for himself. But it's Elim here, so it's the plural of El, but it's not Elohim. And the idea seems to be those who are in the immediate presence of the glory of God. This word can mean, or at least some translate it in some places to mean, angels or mighty ones, like we have here in the New King James. It certainly means, in some places, glorified saints. And there's a parallel to the usage in Psalm 29, where it's not Elim, but everything else is the same in Psalm 96. And there it's from all the families of earth. Psalm 96, verse 7 and 8, or 7 through 9, has everything in verses 1 through 2, and a couple more phrases. But it's likely here that it's both the holy angels and any glorified saints who are in the presence of God. And they are to ascribe unto the Lord glory and strength, the glory due to his name, and they worship in the beauty that is holiness. There's an implication here in verse 2 that one of the reasons why God has created so much that is beautiful is that it is a material picture of something infinitely more beautiful but not visible to the eye, and that is the holiness of God himself. Now, we have something that that recognizes that in New Testament worship. God had a lot of external stuff in Old Testament worship. And now that Christ himself has come, as our confession summarizes it, the ordinances of God in the New Covenant or the New Testament are with less outward glory, but more efficacy and more substance, more true glory. So I've been in a Presbyterian church which very ironically had this arch behind the pulpit up front, and very bright gilt, G-I-L-T, golden, what do you call it? It would be calligraphy if it were small, but it was not small. It is, worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. Well, yes, in the beauty of holiness, not in the beauty of intricately designed arches behind pulpits. It reminded me of being in Coptic Orthodox Church as a kid with the saints and their golden halos and all the interesting stuff in each one's particular picture. You can tell what I paid attention to during the sermons. But in glory, everyone pays attention to God, to his complete otherness. This is what the seraphim, right, in Isaiah 6 say. Holy, holy, holy is Yahweh of hosts. And then to Isaiah's horror, not the whole heavens, but the whole earth is full of his glory. And that makes problems for Isaiah. But we're in Psalm 29. So Yahweh is the glorious God of heaven. But he is also the glorious God in his dealings on earth. And perhaps up until the coming of Christ, never more so than at the flood. And you'll notice that New King James in verse 10, which is calling back to verses 3 through 4, and I think verses 3 through 7, New King James gives you a capital F. And that's because the particular word that's used for flood there is not used anywhere else in the Hebrew Bible except Genesis 6 through 11. So this is not the flood, meaning a storm surge from a hurricane or the overflowing of a river. This is the worldwide flood, which is really the only thing that can make sense of verses 5 through 7, with apologies to those commentators who have seen supposedly a thunderstorm on the slope of the mountain in Lebanon. I have not seen a thunderstorm there. I can imagine that's very impressive. But it, you know, even that doesn't make the mountains of Lebanon and Syrian skip like a young wild ox. But here, The point is, as powerful as the flood is, with its thunder, the voice of Yahweh and the God of glory thunders even over the flood. You can imagine taking the power of the flood and then saying, but that is small by comparison to what the voice of Yahweh is doing. He is completely unfazed by the flood. He sits enthroned above the flood. And here it's describing the splintering of cedar trees and the skipping of the mountains and so forth. The display of his power in the flood reminds us that the wicked shall indeed perish, just as the flood generation did. But it also reminds us that the power that was destroying the wicked in the flood was doing what to Noah? Preserving him. And that's the point that Peter makes in 2 Peter, chapter 2 especially, and I think I think the first several verses of chapter 3 are recalling 2 Peter 2, verses 5 through 9. God is almighty, and he knows how to reserve the wicked for judgment, and he knows how to preserve the righteous for their reward. And he will do both by the same power. And notice that in chapter 3, verses 1 through 8, Peter praises the word of the Lord, the word that created, the word that brought the flood, the word that is still preserving heaven and earth until the last day. Just like it is especially the voice of Yahweh, it is his word, his voice, that is the great display of his power in Psalm 29. So he's the glorious God of heaven. He's the glorious God over the flood. And he's also the glorious God of his church. Verses 8 and 9, there is, I think in verse 9, the deer giving birth and the forests being stripped bare. That's a general reference to how his voice is what does everything in creation. He upholds all things, Hebrews chapter 1 says, by the word of his power. But in particular, talking about the shaking of the wilderness and then the shaking of the wilderness of Kadesh, it's a reminder that the Lord who perhaps after the flood up until Christ, there's no greater display of his power than in the Exodus from Egypt, the plagues, the Red Sea, the time in the wilderness, and then the conquest. That, you know, that one extended window there, that the voice of Yahweh was shaking the wilderness. And the microcosm, the small part for the whole then is especially what he did at the mountain, where Sinai smoked and burned with fire, and his voice thundered, and it sounded like thunder, and the people were terrified. And yet that which strips the forest bare can also make the deer to give birth. And so we see again the greatness of the power of God that is a threat to anything that he decides to shake, and yet that power is exercised for the good of those creatures of whom he takes care. But for all of the flood and wilderness and earthquakes and tornadoes and deer giving birth, the great display of the glory of Yahweh is in the public worship of his people. You can see him communicating that when the temple, when the tabernacle is finally assembled and constructed and they get it set up and they get the ordination of the priest done, and the glory of the Lord comes down. You can see it in the temple to which David was looking forward, and there are some who think that this was one of a number of psalms that David wrote specifically for his son to use when the temple was finally built. And here is the place where the Lord would display his glory, display his redemption. And the greatest thing in that place would be the Lord himself and his word. And the end of verse 9 there is recalling the end of verse 1 and the beginning of verse 2, that the temple is supposed to be heaven on earth, that place where those whom the Lord has gathered to himself, set apart for himself, made holy for himself, see and respond to the greatness of his glory. And that's still true today, isn't it? In the living temple that has Christ as its head, when we gather for public worship, we are there because he has not just created us for himself, but redeemed us for himself by Christ and gathered us to himself in Christ that we may see and respond to his glory. And so he takes what he's said thus far in the psalm in verse 10, summarized under the two statements, Yahweh sat enthroned at the flood, and Yahweh sits as king forever, especially the cherubim, the Ark of the Covenant. He sits enthroned upon the cherubim. In another place, it talks about him sitting upon or dwelling upon the praises of his people. And the marvelous thing is that when the Lord gathers his people to himself, although we rightly, by our creation and our redemption, exist to glorify him, yet our chief end, because he has given that end to us, is not only to glorify him, but fully to enjoy him. Yahweh will give strength to his people. Yahweh will bless his people with peace. He gives us his shalom, which is to say, he gives us all of who he is for all of that for which we could possibly need or desire him. How joyous and grateful we ought to be if we are the people of a God who glorifies himself by strengthening and blessing us. And how ought we to treasure those also whom he treasures? Your God is keeping you. He knows how to reserve the wicked for judgment while he preserves his people for himself. And he is doing so with power that is greater than the flood, greater than Noah's worldwide flood, which splintered cedars and literally moved mountains. So let us rejoice in his glory and seek that that we would delight in him and his holiness the way this psalm teaches us to do. Amen.